when we helped my brother move out of his dorm. So I guess because they're super old dorms, they have like old fireplaces. But then on his mantle, he just had like a bottle of rosé. And he was like, oh, I'm probably not going to drink that. Like, we could just get rid of it. And my mom was like, I like rosé. And I was like, I have never seen you drink rosé.
Your mom's just like, we are not throwing this away.
Yeah. So that was fun.
I would have thought your mom would have like a very specific taste in wine or something.
Her specific taste in wine is like cheap wine.
My mom just drinks the sweetest Moscatos and she calls them mouse cat, unironically.
What?
No, she actually thinks. Yeah. She's been calling them mouse cat since I was like four. Like I literally.
Song blue. Everybody knows what.
Well, welcome to Bottomless Broadway, where we talk musicals over mimosas. This is our last regular episode of the season before we launch our Tony predictions. And the last show we're talking about this season is Neil Diamond.
Which got no Tony nominations.
I didn't expect it to do so poorly in general in terms of reviews, even though I don't think we enjoyed it particularly. But the thing is, the current generation of jukebox musicals is not about artists that are of our generation, you know?
Right.
So whenever we watch like Cher, Donna Summer, Tina Turner, Carole King, I'm just like, it was fine. Like I had fun. Some of the songs were good. It was a good time. And then there was always old people that are like, this is amazing. So I figured this was the same thing. I was like, yeah, I didn't love it, but it seems like of the same mold. And then I look at reviews and I'm like, oh shit, people hated this.
Yeah. But I mean, they have an audience for it. So I look at the grosses every week and they've been making pretty close to $1 million every week, which is not an easy feat. But wow. They've been doing that with like 75% capacity. So just all these people who are buying, I guess, regular price tickets, and they've kept the ticket price high enough.
I mean, it was packed when we went.
Yeah. Now I actually kind of like the Neil Diamond songs.
I have to say, I did start enjoying a number of the songs, but I thought I was giving myself like Stockholm syndrome because yeah. I started listening to them so much. All right, then. Should I just start with the summary?
Sure.
And then we'll do our five words. Okay. So, well, actually, did I just say this episode's about Neil Diamond? I guess technically it's about A Beautiful Noise, the Neil Diamond musical, which is, in case you haven't figured it out, about Neil Diamond. The show is bookended with, and also kind of like narrated throughout, by conversations with an older current Neil Diamond and his therapist. And it starts kind of ominous. He walks into his therapist's room and he's like, my whole family told me that I have to come here because I'm too hard to be around. So immediately you're like, oh, this guy went through some shit, you know? But then we spend the next 2.5 hours going through his very uneventful life for a rock star. It goes through kind of his first marriage, how it failed, his second marriage, how it failed, and how he came to fame, starting first as a songwriter because he didn't think he had a good voice because it's kind of unique. And then his talent agent like picked up on his voice and thought it was really interesting, but he has this internal struggle of like not ever having planned on or wanted to be a performer. So he does go through your classic artist struggles of being on the road and not having a home. But there's not any specific plot points that I can really point to. You know, I feel like that is the summary. It was giving me like a little bit whiplash at the end because then they suddenly went back into his childhood and you think that his family fucked him up, but they didn't. The therapist actually has like a copy of his repertoire or something and is just going through his songs and pointing at lyrics and be like, what is this about? What is that about? And then each of those flash back to the point in his life where he like writes the song. And I guess that's it.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of segues into what my five words are going to be, which is just jukeboxes need strong framing devices. People who have listened to this podcast know that we love Jersey Boys. And I think what Jersey Boys did really well was it had a very strong framing device because it was about the Four Seasons. They could use the Four Seasons to sort of chart the rise and fall of the band members and their relationship with each other in the band. And also because there were four of them, they each got a turn to tell their side of the story. Here, I think they tried with a framing device to have the therapist there. But like you said, we still don't really understand why he's in therapy. And I think the last 30 minutes tries to do all that work of like, and this is why he's in therapy, and this is the challenge he needs to overcome. And we saw like no sign of that until those last few minutes. If we had understand why he was struggling, because I mean, he lived a pretty good life, and like, especially compared to, you know, all the women who got beat by their husbands.
All the minority women that have been dominating jukebox musicals on Broadway.
I mean, I remember also when they first announced this, because it was produced by Bob Gaudio of the Four Seasons and written by the guy who wrote the screenplay for Bohemian Rhapsody, which we also love. And I was like, wow, this is going to be great.
I really don't believe in the therapist as a framing device for him at all. They would really have to change the musical a lot. People can need therapy and have mental health issues for absolutely no reason. It doesn't have to be because of childhood trauma or like marriage trauma or anything, obviously. But I think that is him, and that's totally fine. But nothing that the therapist is talking to him about really relates back to any point in his life in a very special way. So it's just like they talk about stuff and they flash back into like a time in his life. And it's like, I don't even know what's relating. It's just because the therapist read that song from this repertoire book. Mm-hmm. That scene and the time in his life when he wrote that song or whatever doesn't even explain why he feels the way he feels right now or why he's in therapy. You know, like in MJ, at the climax, it's like his dad is this monster. It's just nothing like that. It's not like anything that he's talking to the therapist about is because of something that happened. All of the people in his life were fairly decent. Yeah, it's funny how you were saying you liked the songs on me, because the initial five words I thought of was "it almost grew on me." But the one that I landed on, which also relates to what we're talking about, is did he deserve a musical? Because I think it's not he had a boring life, and I'm sure that he's very famous and very deserving of how much people love him and everything, but his life for a rock star is just so chill. He got married, he divorced, no one abused nobody, he cheated on his wife in as sensitive a way as possible, if you're going to cheat, I guess. They had an amicable divorce. Then he had a second wife. He didn't have enough time for her. So over time, they grew apart. And it's just like between that, he's writing music, he's touring. Like the most dramatic thing that happened to him is God came into his motel room and helped him write Sweet Caroline. Yeah. And like we're talking about, a lot of the recent jukebox biopics have been about women, which, you know, they have to like overcome abuse and discrimination and everything to get to where they are. And he has to overcome the fact that he sulks a lot. I don't really know. And the other thing is, over listening to the songs in the cast album, I did grow to like quite a couple. And I also think there are a few that were done well, like on stage in this production. I especially like a lot of the songs from his second wife, but I have a hard time imagining them as being these incredible hits on the radio.
Okay, the thing that I want to say about his music is I think he is actually really good at writing a hook. Like, I think Crackling Rosie has a great hook.
I love that one.
Yeah. Once you listen to the songs, especially if you listen to the originals, they just kind of repeat without any changes. There's no development over the course of the song. And I was like, okay, so I'm down to listen to this song for about 30 seconds and then I get bored. Which also I wanted to say, I thought the show did well because there's a lot of medleys where they only play the song for 30 seconds. So they did great on that.
You know who has great songs start to finish is Billy Joel. I honestly, this is so mean, but when I was watching this show, it felt like I was listening to a bunch of like Billy Joel B-side songs. I was just like, these are fine. They're pleasant, but I cannot imagine each of them being a hit single. Mm-hmm. I just don't know how he got there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I also think that young Neil Diamond is 20 years too late for Broadway, because young Neil Diamond has that emo boy aesthetic that I think would have slapped 20 years ago. He reminds me of like JD from Heathers. He wears all black. His hair's black. He like mumbles to the floor.
We saw the Neil Diamond alternate. It's Nick Frattiani. If we talk about like the Neil Diamond actor, we are not talking about Will Swenson, who is the normal Neil Diamond. But yeah.
But so I saw him at the Easter Bonnet end.
Oh, yeah.
His talking voice is not normal. I mean, like his talking voice is the voice of Neil Diamond. I thought he had a regular talking voice.
It's a beautiful night. And it's a sound that I love. And it makes me feel good.
They call the ensemble the noise because, you know, it's a beautiful noise, whatever. That's also the song that they open on, is a beautiful noise. Really, it's not much going on. I literally don't even remember how we first meet old Neil Diamond in therapy, because it's not part of a song. So
I think she's just like, why are you here? And he's like, my family can't stand me no more. And then I think she finds the I'm a Believer song, and then they cut to him trying to pitch songs to the talent agent.
Then he like pulls out I'm a Believer, and all of a sudden I was like, oh my god, I didn't know he wrote this song. I thought fucking Smash Mouth wrote that song. And it was also shocking to me when I discovered that they weren't even the original ones that sang it. It was actually the Monkees. And then I had to look up if All Star was actually a Smash Mouth song or not, because then I had trust issues.
The talent agent that he pitches to is Ellie Greenwich. She comes back over and over, but she's his main in.
Yeah.
And she's this cutthroat, like she's a woman. It's, what is this, like the 60s or something? And she's 60s, running the music industry. She's like known for being able to pick out all the hits. So she's like pretty cutthroat. She's like, nope, not that song, not that song. And then I'm a Believer comes on and she's like, I like this. And then, you know, it gets picked and sung. So he has a career now, I guess, which is good because he has a baby.
So what I liked partially about the MJ musical, it also showed his creative process and showed sort of why he was such a artist that people really cared about, because he was very exacting and kind of a perfectionist and he really wanted to put on a good show and stuff like that. And you don't really understand Neil Diamond as an artist from this show. Like,
Neil
you don't
Diamond
know.
Just gets Jesus in his motel room.
You don't know why he became famous. Like, yeah, he started writing for people and then he started doing his own stuff. But you don't see where he gets his inspiration from. You don't really see.
It also
see,
sounds like some of his genius is like from his depression. Because that is the main reason he marries his second wife, based on this show. I don't know about real life, obviously. Based on this show, the main reason he marries his second wife is because they're both depressed, which is not how you pick a partner. I was like, no, don't trauma bond your wife.
But yeah, so I'm a Believer goes big, and then he's just like, we have no problems anymore.
And then I saw her face.
The next song is another medley, but at this point he's sort of made it, like he's not made it, but he has like some rapport, I guess. So he can bring songs to agents and then they'll help him find singers for them, I guess.
Yeah.
So the demo medley is basically all these performers going through his songs. And then the agent, Ellie, is like, okay, you sound good on this song. You can take this song. Until they get to Kentucky Woman, where, I don't know, this one guy is singing Kentucky Woman. And then Neil is like, no. And his voice is so annoying. I really hate him. He's like, no, no, man. No, that's not how I heard the song at all, actually. The way I heard it, it had a lot more soul. It's like, get the fuck out of here. I'm so annoyed with him in this scene. Oh, so he takes over the mic. You know, he sings it with his own, like, chain smoker voice that he's known for. And then Ellie is like, you should be a singer. You don't sound like anyone I've ever heard before, but your voice fits your own songs very well. And then he ends up performing at a small club, I guess, to try it out.
The club is the bitter end, where he meets his, who is going to become his second wife, Marsha. And to quote Larissa after she saw it, she was like, Marsha is so slay. And that pretty much sums up Marsha pretty well.
Marsha is very, very cool. She's definitely like the highlight of this show.
Yeah.
And then so he performs this Solitary Man on stage?
I think so,
or,
yeah.
No, or he performs Cracklin' Rose. I don't know.
Cracklin' He Rose. Might as well have done both, because who the fuck knows?
He probably did do both, actually. Yeah. That's what we're going to say. I don't remember Cracklin' Rosie from the show, but I do really enjoy it.
Same. I remember Solitary Man because I was like, wow, this bitch is so dramatic. And I don't really remember Cracklin' Rosie either. Oh, wait. Remember when he like signed a record deal with the gang?
Oh, yeah.
That was a hot sec. Wow, they could have made that such a bigger deal.
We know when that comes up, though, because doesn't he write Sweet Caroline to get out of that?
Oh, yeah.
So we'll get there. So it was Cracklin' Rosie about a prostitute? It's like, you're a store-bought woman, but you make me sing. Cracklin' Rosie, make me smile. Girl, if it lasts for an hour, that's all right.
Or is it about drugs?
True.
Oh, wait, hold on. This is from Wikipedia. Cracklin' Rosé is the name of an inexpensive sparkling wine once produced by Andre Wine of British Columbia, Canada, which is popular among the indigenous population.
So apparently it's about rosé?
Yeah.
No need to say please to no man for a happy toll. Oh, I love my rosy child. You got the way to make me happy. You and me, we go in style. Cracklin' Rose, your store-bought woman, but you make me sing like a guitar humming. So hang on to me, girl, our song keeps running on.
And then I would say the first number that actually stood out on stage comes up after this, which is Song Sung Blue.
Yeah.
So this is also when Marsha, the sleigh girl, shows up. So that's probably why this is so memorable. So he performs at this shitty little club, and Marsha is waitressing there, I think.
Club manager, maybe? Was she that cool, or was she just...
Or like the host? I don't know.
Yeah.
She was like close with the owner, but I thought it was just like a tiny little venue. So maybe she was also waitressing. Unclear. I don't know. But the performance goes well. He's a hit at this little club, but it ends and he just doesn't seem that happy. And Marsha's already kind of eyeing him anyway. So she's like, what's up with you? Why are you so sad? And he's just like, I'm a sad fucking man. And she's like, I'm sad too. But like, she's kind of like, you don't really have reasons to be sad because you're doing pretty well in life, which is what all of us are thinking. And then she tells this story about how like her grandma told her that everyone has a happy wolf and a sad wolf in their head. And you have to feed the happy wolf if you want to be happy. And then they bond over depression. And then they sing Song Sung Blue, which is basically about that. Because yeah, Song Sung Blue, everybody knows one. Song Sung Blue, every garden grows one. It's just like everybody feels sad sometimes. And they do like a little kick line. It wasn't the most amazing song, but I did enjoy it a lot.
It was the song with the most stuff happening on stage up till now that wasn't one of the medleys. And this felt like it had a little bit of plot progression in it. I just remember trying to figure out what the fuck they were saying, because I was like, Song Sung Blue? Like, what does that mean?
I miraculously did hear Song Sung Blue, so I understood this one. But by Suleiman, I was gone.
Song Sung Blue, weeping like a willow.
Oh, cheer up, Hamlet.
Song Sung Sung Blue, sleeping on my pillow. Before you know it, get to feeling good.
You simply got no choice.
Then we get to Cherry Cherry, September Morn.
Cherry Cherry, and it's the one that's like, baby loves me. Yeah, yeah, she does.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that one.
On the track list, it is sung with his first wife.
Isn't it when he records the first song that he's releasing or something? And I remember his wife was in the studio, so maybe she ends up starting to sing with him.
Oh, also, I guess we should say, at the end of Song Sung Blue, you can definitely tell that and Marsha are having a thing because
they kiss.
And Marsha's like, how does it feel? And he's like, I'm a married man with a second child on the way. And we're all just like, all right, man.
The show does such a good job of making Marsha a very lovable mistress. Yeah. Everyone's already on Marsha's side.
Yeah, pretty much. Then we get to Love on the Rocks afterwards, which is kind of like this show's equivalent of My Eyes Adored You, where it's just like, we are going to break up now. This part was a little bit interesting where he is like, and this is how it happened. And I told her that we couldn't be together anymore. And she was like, you're right. And then the therapist cuts
she told
in.
Him that they can't be together anymore.
All right. Yeah. So she told him we can't be together anymore. Like, you love someone else. Like, this can't be happening. And the therapist is like, oh, that was really easy. Is that actually how it happened? And then he sort of rewinds and it goes into a little bit more, slightly more emotional crying.
This is also kind of like Not a Day Goes By.
Yeah.
Because, well, so in Merrily, you know how Beth is like, did you sleep with her, Frank? And he's like, yeah. And she's like, then there's no chance for us. And which is fair. But in Love on the Rocks, it's like even more fair because, like Frank, another idiot, Neil Diamond is like, let's stay together. We can work it out. And his wife is like, but do you love Marsha? And he's like, I do. And she's like, so what the fuck is your problem?
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, this guy needs to figure out his life. I mean, it was kind of cool that the song was able to fit the scene before his therapist was like asking him if that's how it really happened. And then afterwards, when it got more dramatic, it still mostly worked.
Yeah.
And I think another thing that we talked about leaving the show is it's nice that he doesn't badmouth any of his wives in this show. Like in every single failed relationship, he was like, this is my fault. And that's nice. I appreciate that. But I also feel like it's like a little self-serving. Like, it makes him seem like a really good person. But it's like, right. No, you were still the shitty husband twice. And it doesn't really show any of the aftermath of the failed relationships. Like, the show just carries on with what he does next career-wise. But then we don't really see what his first wife has to, like, go through, like, post-divorce or anything. So it's just also,
I mean, the
like,
second wife got all the famous friends, so.
And all the money.
Yeah.
This is why she's a slay, because she literally took all his shit at the end, yeah. Which all of us were like, you deserve that, babe.
I guess he's on tour. That's when Hello Again happens. He's like, I miss you. I'm on tour.
Oh, he calls his first wife. He was like, can I talk to my daughters? And she's like, no, we have 18 girls over for a sleepover. Well, maybe he calls both wives.
He's just like a needy guy who needs some sort of female to talk to.
He called the second wife too before he writes Sweet Caroline because, you know, it's this dramatic part where he's like, the studio booked me for 3 songs, but I only have 2. The studio that's booking him is also the mob, right. Which we have not really talked about properly.
They didn't either, so it's fine.
Like, there's one scene where, like, someone convinces him to sign a contract and then turns out it's the mob, and then he wants to back out and they threaten to shoot him. But the guy that was originally his point of contact was like, listen, just give us one hit album and we'll let you go. So I guess that adds to the stress as well. But he calls his second wife after he calls his first wife, and he's complaining about how he doesn't have enough songs. And Marcia, this is one of the few times where she is a little bit disappointing, because I feel like the show makes her seem like she's able to, like, help him, and she says something revolutionary that helps unlock his mind.
Well, she was literally just like, when I first met you, you had so many songs that you had ideas for.
She's like, try to be that person again. I'm like, this is not helpful advice. But, you know, luckily Jesus comes, and then that's what heavenly progression is, because he's like, I've played a chord progression that I've never played before. I love how they can't even say that it's a new chord progression or one that American pop music didn't know or anything like that. They're just like, he has never played it before.
I was low-key falling asleep at this point, and I knew that Sweet Caroline was the first act closer. Also, this is, like, kind of a short show. It's 2:15 with a 15 intermission, so it's 2 hours total for of actual material. And all of a sudden, he started playing Sweet Caroline, and I was like, oh my god, we're already at Sweet Caroline? I was like, wow, I must have actually fallen asleep. But no, it's just a short first act.
We were also like, a lifetime of no domestic abuse can save you 15 minutes in your jukebox yeah. musical.
I remember when I found out that Sweet Caroline was the first act closer, I was like, then what's the point of the second act? For MJ, they saved Thriller as the last song, though they teased it so hard throughout the first act. For New York, New York, they saved New York, New York as the last song. That's just what you're supposed to do.
Here, I was like, yeah, but MJ didn't have to do that because Michael Jackson has so many good songs.
I mean, Sweet Caroline, it was well staged. Of course, like, everyone goes crazy for it. I think they tried to get the crowd to sing along.
Is this when he changes into a glittery outfit?
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting that, because before he's a performer,
it's part of the heavenly intervention. Okay. I mean, that was the first act. That's probably the quickest we've ever talked through a first act.
There's also definitely more songs in the first act than the second. So
yeah, I'm like looking through the second act songs, and it's basically just like he tours, and then he finishes therapy.
Hands, touching hands, reaching out, touching me, touching you. Sweet Caroline, ba, ba, ba. Good times never seem so good.
Yeah, so the first actual song in the second act is Brother Love's Traveling Salvation Show, which I think is just his travel song for while he's touring.
What's Play Me?
That's when he calls home. You start to see a little bit about his marriage with Marcia slipping, where she's like, oh, like, you bought me diamonds.
Yeah,
and he's like, it's because I'm so thankful for you for understanding that I can't always be there and that I'm on tour and I'm gone a lot. And I promise that after this tour, I'll come home. And she's smart enough to be like, don't make me promises you can't keep, because you're going to keep touring. At that time, she was kind of like, it's fine. But as we will soon find out, it was not.
So they moved to California, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Forever in Blue Jeans. Next number. Another pretty good number, mainly because Marcia's in it. This is the one where, if people remember us talking about it like 2 episodes ago, I was like, I think they deserve a choreo nomination just because of how hard she strutted.
Yeah. Well, so, okay, Marcia's played by Robin Herder. She definitely was the best part of the show. She, like, had the most stage presence. I was just, like, obsessed with Forever in Blue Jeans because she was so hot strutting on that stage. I just, like, didn't even realize she only strutted for a whole song. Also, her vocals are very good on this, too, I think. But then I was listening to, like, the actual version of Forever in Blue Jeans, and I was like, wow, this song is very repetitive.
I genuinely wonder if, like, Marcia sang more songs, if I would like more songs. Because I feel like she enunciates, she belts, like, she just brings more to the song than Neil Diamond. Forever in Blue Jeans, when it comes up on the album, makes me so excited. Like, the first refrain of Money Talks, but it don't sing and dance and it don't walk. Yeah. I'm just immediately like, I feel like this is one of the best lines in the entire show.
So, you know how we're like, well, like, Marcia just needs to be in more of the show and it would be a better show. And we also said that about Tommy in New York, New York. Well, the two actors are married to each other, so they just need to do a show together.
And, like, no,
that would just be an
serious?
Amazing show. Yeah.
That's crazy. She's so much hotter than him. He's really punching. Oh, my God. Good for them. They're both good actors. Is she even in Jeans? She is in Jeans.
She is.
But earlier, yeah. I think it's like around Baby Loves Me. Yeah, yeah, she does. Right before the breakup song with his first wife. Mm-hmm. He's singing, but she's just casually like wearing this mini red dress and sitting on like a bar chair and just like kicking her legs up really high and doing a chair dance.
Yeah. She did do that. Wow, I completely forgot. I was so confused about this show because it kept getting nominated for choreography noms. Like, it didn't actually get a Tony nom for it, but like in all the other awards leading up to the Tonys, including the Cheetah Rivera Awards, which are like a dance-based award, like it got nominated for everything. And I was like, was there dance in this? And then you were like, well, she strutted for a whole song. I was like, I still don't remember anything else. So she dances twice, I guess. But it actually won the Cheetah Rivera Award. And I was like, what? For what?
That's wild.
So I think maybe the ensemble dance is lost. But she also like won the Individual Performer Award.
That's good. They did not make us focus on the ensemble dancing very well. I don't know what to say.
Money talks, but it can't sing and dance and it can't walk. And if you pardon me, I'd like to say we'll do okay forever in blue jeans, babe. Maybe.
So then we hit the stadium melody.
It's him performing while she's trying to call him and be like, I would just like to talk to my husband for 5 minutes, but he is too busy and he keeps extending his tour. So I never know when he's going to be back. So I'm just hanging out with Meryl Streep or whoever else is in LA.
It's so dramatic. She's like, I'm trying to figure out when you're going to come home. And don't tell me check the tour schedule because I checked your tour schedule and it says more dates to be announced. Hence the call, baby. Hence the call. I'm like, Jesus Christ. It's just like, I don't know. I feel like she didn't talk that way for the whole show except for in this song.
And that's when you know their relationship's not going to last. I do want to just call out Crunchy Granola Sweet really quickly, which is part of this stadium medley. Because I kind of went down a rabbit hole for this song because it's just such a ridiculous song. Like,
oh, I looked into it too. Because I was like, for this entire medley, I basically had two thoughts watching the show. My first thought was, is he pronouncing Solomon wrong? And then my second thought was, does he think he's Weird Al? Like, that was basically the Suleiman and Crunchy Granola Sweet medley.
Okay, so like the lyrics of Crunchy Granola Sweet, which also, by the way, Crunchy Granola Sweet is a song that they use in dancing. The lyrics start out with, I got a song been on my mind and the tune can be sung and the words all rhyme. And I'm like, you already don't rhyme your words. But then he's like, though it don't say much and it won't offend. If you sing it at school, they're liable to send you home. Like, what? And then he's just like, let me hear that. Get me near that crunchy granola sweet. Drop your shrink and stop your drinking. Crunchy granola's neat. It was very confusing.
So I looked into both of these songs because I was so confused. So apparently Suleiman is about him asking a deity to bring him back home. And that's why he has this God of my days, God of my nights or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he's basically just like, I need to find a way to get back to what's important and get back to my family. Crunchy Granola, actually, he's a little bit of a genius. I'm not going to lie, because apparently it's about the SoCal lifestyle because they just moved to Hollywood. He invented the current granola girl trend. But it's basically just like he grew up in Brooklyn. He moved to LA after he got famous. And he's talking about the crunchy granola life, whatever the equivalent in the 80s was of like going vegan, being miraculously happy and running 5 miles every morning and this like perfect SoCal granola life is apparently what it's about. So like drop your shrink, stop your drinking, crunchy granola is neat. He's just like, yeah, I'm gonna live in Southern California and get a tan and wear Chacos and miraculously be happy. So that's what it's about. I did not get that one bit during the show. I was just confused. But now that I know all of that, when it leads into his second divorce, it makes so much more sense now. Let me hear that, get me near that, crunchy granola sweet.
Stop your drinking, crunchy granola to me. Sing it out. All right. Sing it out. All right. All right. All right. All right. Then his tour actually ends. So he goes home, but he goes home like a day before he told Marsha that he was going to go home because he wanted to surprise her. But when he arrives, he realizes that she's not really sitting at the edge of her seat waiting for him to come home. Like, she's expecting him tomorrow. She's probably looking forward to it, but she has made herself a life in LA with famous Hollywood friends, like, because like... Yeah. He's never home. So I think she's literally like out to get brunch with Barbara Streisand or something. And she's just like, I can cancel. And he's like, no, don't cancel. But they just realize that they have these completely separate lives now. So that's when they sing You Don't Bring Me Flowers. So, you know, he left his first wife because he was cheating. This one, it's more just like they're growing apart. So it's like a little more sentimental. And they just talk about how it used to be and how in love they were and how natural it felt, but now you don't bring me flowers, you don't do any cute shit for me. And it's a duet, and right after this they have a divorce. He gives a mini monologue where he's like, to her credit, Marsha didn't get mad, she got even. I was like, this is not a Disney Channel ad. But he was just like, yeah, she got like all three houses in Beverly Hills and basically all of my shit. So good for her.
Pretty much. He does talk about meeting his third wife and how much that changed his life. He is technically, I think, still with his third wife now. So I guess that worked out for him. I guess therapy worked out for him. But we do, I guess, go mostly to old Neil Diamond now in therapy. I guess one thing I do want to mention about the therapist that I thought was a smart move that they could have capitalized on a little bit more. Obviously, 85% of this audience are Neil Diamond fans. But for us, I knew maybe two Neil Diamond songs. The therapist in the beginning mentioned she's not actually like a Neil Diamond fan.
She's us.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think she's the stand-in for people like us because she's literally like, I'm sorry, I don't know the song. I'm sorry, I don't know that song. But when it gets to Sweet Caroline, she's literally like, oh my gosh, I know this one.
That's exactly what I was getting at. Yeah. I thought that was kind of smart to do it that way. Brooklyn Roads in America, it starts to, you know, the classic therapy question of like, tell me about your childhood. And he talks about his parents were immigrants and they came and he grew up in Brooklyn. They were kind of discriminated against, I guess, or they were just poor. But because his parents were like Russian and Polish and Jewish. And they'd sort of do the scene where they show all the immigrants. I guess it's supposed to be like a generational trauma thing. Oh, and he talks about how he was always like a quiet kid
and he never really did much. And his parents were also just expecting him to like want to go out or play with friends or like do whatever. But he was always different.
That, I think, was the main takeaway. I don't think he experienced a ton of the first generation immigrant of like running away from shit. It's mostly his parents being like, no, because we're immigrants, like we've seen some shit and we want to make sure that you end up better than us. But he is just like a quiet kid. And they make a big deal of like him having an imaginary friend, which is just not that crazy for like a 10-year-old. Mm-hmm. I feel like they just go really hard into trying to be like, oh, he's always been different and quiet and weird and emo. And that's why he's so hard on himself and he's been depressed his whole life. And I don't know. I think you can just be depressed for no reason, but I don't think it's because he had an imaginary friend.
Well, I think they only mentioned the imaginary friend because that's what Shiloh is about. And Shiloh, I think, is supposed to be his song where he reckons with himself as a child and stuff. Because first of all, it's not even sung by him. It's sung by this guy with a guitar who on the cast album is Jordan Dobson, a.k.a. Prince Sebastian in Bad Cinderella. So I guess he used to be in the show and then left. Yeah, wild, right? So I actually do like Shiloh.
Well, okay. So before we get there, I love how his mom is like, he has an imaginary friend. And then his dad is like, it's just because the Dodgers left town. They left a hole in all of us because the Dodgers... and then like the mom is just like, are you fucking crazy? Like Neil doesn't care about Dodgers. That's not like what he's about. But the dad clearly does. He's just like, it's because the Dodgers left town. That is what's making my 10-year-old depressed. And because the Dodgers famously left Brooklyn for LA, which to his dad's credit, Neil Diamond did follow the Dodgers 20 years later. So I mean,
maybe it was all about the Dodgers the whole time.
Could have been all about the Dodgers. That's my headcanon. Yes, Shiloh.
I do like the song a lot. And while, you know, random person is singing it with a guitar, it's just sort of showing scenes from his childhood. So I guess it's where he reckons with what his childhood was like. But also, it's not even like he had a terrible, terrible childhood.
Young child with dreams, dreaming each dream on your own.
See what we got for you? A guitar.
When children play, seems like you'd end up alone.
Your first gold record.
Papa said he'd love to be with you if he had the time.
Neil F***ing Diamond.
So you turn to the only friend you can find there in your mind.
The therapist is like, oh, King, you use that word a lot. Let's dive into that. And this is where he's like, oh, well, I used to be the king of selling records or whatever, more than Elvis and all that shit. And now he can't tour anymore. He's like not, I'm guessing, not really making as much music anymore. So I was like, okay, this is probably the most interesting part of the show. Up until now, old Neil Diamond has just sat in an armchair. He just probably sits in that armchair the whole show until we get to this song, which I guess it's supposed to be like his breakthrough moment. It's I Am, I Said. Also don't really know what the song means, but I did like this song because it does feel like a little bit of a climactic moment. It's kind of cool to see like old people belt. He's still got it. I was just like, good for you, man.
I don't really know what it's about either. When I left the Toft Archives, it was like really nice weather, so I just took a lap around Lincoln Center while listening to this album because I was preparing for a recording. And when I Am, I Said came on, I didn't even consciously realize immediately, but I just felt so good about myself. I felt so empowered and entitled. I don't know why I feel so amazing right now. And then I realized it was this song because it's just like, I don't even know.
in this song, he says, did you ever read about a frog who dreamed of being a king and then became one? Well, except for the names and a few other changes, if you talk about me, the story is the same one. But I got an emptiness deep inside and I've tried, but it won't let me go. And I'm not a man who likes to swear, but I never cared for the sound of being alone. I mean, I think another thing they could have tried to dive into a little more was his depression. And we talked about how the way the show presented it, we were kind of like, you don't really have things to be depressed about. But obviously, depression is also a mental illness that can occur even when you don't really have reasons to be depressed. And I feel like if the show wanted to dive into that, that could have also been an interesting thing where like everything in his life was great, but he, in his head, was still depressed or was still unsatisfied or like something like that. Would have at least made it slightly more interesting for him as a character.
Such an interesting thing to explore because like a lot of the jukebox musical we were talking about with the minority women that are getting abused, it's so much about like them overcoming all of that abuse and being a fucking diva. And they don't even really talk about the mental health aspect of it. The only time when I've seen them do this is in the Aretha movie musical. Mm-hmm. Where like so much shit has happened to her that like when she's in her second marriage, she's just like kind of a dickhead.
Yeah.
So yeah, like that's not really something that's ever been done before. That could have been so cool. Also, were you offended when he talks about how cheap rent is in LA? Because I mean, you can tell this is last century because he's like,
the rents are low.
Like, yes. One plus that LA has over New York is that it's so cheap. And I was like, fuck you, man.
Well, I'm New York City born and raised, but nowadays I'm lost between two shores. LA's fine, but it ain't home. New York's home, but it ain't mine no more. I am, I said, to no one there, and no one heard at all, not even the chair.
So he gets this big whole reckoning. The last song is Holly Holy, and young Neil Diamond gets to sing again. I think he's back in sequence again also. Mm-hmm. And this is really like not a plot song at all. I think he says he's like willing to come back to therapy again because the therapist is just like, oh, like that was your first breakthrough. We've still got a lot of work to do. And he's like, okay, maybe now I see the value of therapy. So they sort of leave it at that. And then young Neil Diamond just comes on to sing one more song, which I guess must be a fairly popular song, but I had never heard of it before. So I was just like, all right, random song that we decided to end on, I guess.
It was kind of a weak ending. I guess maybe they wanted something a little less dramatic, but I Am My Said would have been a better closing number.
Or just like go back to the Megamix or something, you know, just throw in another medley and do all the greatest hits again. And I mean, they did do Sweet Caroline as an encore song. So
it definitely feels like if you have 39 albums, the team for this musical should not have been like grasping at straws for a finale.
Yeah.
It's a little bit rough.
I mean, maybe it was a popular song for the people who know Neil Diamond. So
that wraps up this show. And we don't need to talk about Tony nominations because they didn't get any.
Yeah, I'll just ask this anyway, even though I feel like I know the answer. What do you think was the best number in the show?
Wait, I don't think I know the answer. I feel like it's not even Sweet Caroline. Is it Sweet Caroline for you?
Oh, well, I was going to say Forever in Blue Jeans.
Oh, okay. I do love that one. And I also like Cracklin' Rosie. And I also like most of Marsha's songs. And I do like I Am My, I Said. But right, none of them are like, oh, I'm dying to see this number again.
That's
or
true.
Or like, I wish they would do this song for a Tony performance. I don't feel that strongly about anything. Mm-hmm. I think Forever in Blue Jeans is so impressive because she really fills the stage as one person by just walking in an X in her jeans, for, like strutting in an X for the entire song.
Yeah. I mean, I think I Am, I Said is probably the best number, like dramaturgically in terms of moving the story as much as it can be moved and stuff like that. I mean, I think Brooklyn Roads in America is pretty good, partly because America is just also a big song. Like, it was the only other song of his that I knew. And It does sort of tell a story, even if it's like not that clear what the purpose of the story is. So There's that for
I did think I Am I Said, like, it was a little emotional because we haven't really seen old Neil Diamond sing up until this point.
Yeah. I mean, as far as Tony nominations go, I definitely would have given this book over New York, New York. Even if some of the lines are like kind of clunky, like the ones that are on the cast album. But it told a story, even if the story wasn't that interesting.
Here's the thing, is New York, New York had to look at a bunch of songs and figure out a brand new story. Whereas here, they just had to frame his life well, because like the story is written. Mm. It's just like, how are they going to tell it? And they didn't tell it that well either. And on top of that, the story to begin with wasn't really there.
This really should have just been a tribute concert or something.
I don't want to offend like Neil Diamond fans, because I believe that like he was great. But I think like just because you were a famous musician doesn't necessarily mean that you deserve a biopic. Like, you need to have an exciting life for me to want to watch your story. I think the writers didn't really take the time to map out how the story should be. Because, okay, so you know for like how for my songwriting class we were like adapting a scene. Mm-hmm. And so you can write the song based on the scene line for line and just trying to make things rhyme. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't actually work that way in a song, because you have to figure out how you're going to frame it and what's going to be your hook and like what you're going to repeat and what's the important part of that scene. I feel like that's what they did here, where they just took his life story and like laid it out and tried to frame it with the therapist, but they didn't really grasp one really important theme or conflict in his life to move the plot forward or like get us hooked. It felt like someone interviewed him and then just told you what happened without having creative say over how to present it in a way that makes it a good story.
Yeah. And I mean, I didn't hate this leaving it. Kind of like you said at the beginning of this episode, I thought it was just one of those shows that all the older generation was obsessed with because they love Neil Diamond. Beautiful got great reviews. And I also thought that was kind of boring, just because I wasn't really into the Carole King music. And, you know, like, her life was interesting-ish, but it was also a little, like, cliche.
And I wasn't crazy about Donna Summer, Tina Turner, who just passed, or Cher. Like, I was, I left this show and I was just kind of like, oh, like, there were a few bops, you know, it didn't drag. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a super interesting life, but they also didn't make it a long show. So I was like, you know, the length is reasonable. And I think it's just not one of those shows that's for us. That's how I felt.
And then all the other reviewers agreed.
So that's rough.
Yeah. I mean, I think you summed it up best when you were like, I thought it was kind of boring, but it's not his fault for having a boring life.
That's what it is. You can't blame the guy.
Yeah. Our next episode will be within the week, in a few days.
It'll be Friday or Saturday.
So you will see our Tony predictions episode go up sometime this weekend before the Tonys. And be sure to stay subscribed to us if you would like to get notified when that happens. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast player of your choice. You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at BottomlessBway, or email us at bottomlessbway@gmail.com. Otherwise, let us know what your Tony predictions are, and we will talk to you again then.
Follow that.